Have you ever heard that Brazil has only big coffee producers? Well, the story is not like that, and this episode will explain why.
Your podcast with a little bit of Brazilian coffee. Café.
Hello everyone, it's really nice to have you back. I'm Kelly Stein and this is Coffee, your podcast, with some information about Brazilian coffee production. Before I introduce my very special guest today, I'd like to say thank you for all your messages and emails. Thank you very much for your audience, and I would like to invite you to check also our website, where you can find lots of information about the project and how you can contribute to keep this project online, bringing information about coffee production here in Brazil. So today, it's really interesting subject because I travel a lot and I talk to lots of coffee lovers abroad, and these foreigner people who works with coffee or just consume Brazilian coffee, they have some assumptions, questions and doubts about Brazilian coffee. For this reason, I decided to make some English episodes, even though my accent is weird and I might have some problems with the grammar. So just ignore the accent and focus the information. I'm sure you enjoy the ride. So today, to clarify all this information and give us some historical background, I invited Carlos Brando. Welcome, Carlos.
Thank you very much, Kelly. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So you help me to clarify very basic stuff. But before that, I would like you to introduce and tell your story in coffee.
Well, I started in coffee back in 1983. In a very unlikely way, because I used to study in the US and I used to come to Brazil for the summer and had friends in the Pinhalense company that makes machinery. I started to say they were not doing the right thing in exporting the equipment, and they said, well, you're so smart when I returned and you try to do it. And I made an indecent proposal to them, not in terms of the payment, but in terms of the money it would require to do it, and they accepted.
Great.
So that was the beginning. When I started with Pinhalense, they used to export to 12 countries. In 10 years, we got it to 55. And then we decided between Pinhalense and my team that we should leave and create a different company, that's P&A, our company, that exports Pinhalense equipment today to 93 countries in the five continents.
Wow.
So that's in brief the story. And after that, when we parted from Pinhalense in a friendly way to be their export arm, we entered into consulting and then into advertising, export of quality coffee, and then roasting.
Oh my goodness.
And we're coffee farmers too.
All focused in coffee.
All focused in coffee. So when people ask us, we say we're very diversified in what we do, but for one single project.
For a complete solution, right?
Complete solution. And we say, when people hire us as consultants, we say we're consultants who do what we're proposing.
The whole chain.
The whole chain.
Some people don't know exactly what Pinhalense is.
Well, Pinhalense is a maker of machinery. And when I say that, the first thing people think is machines to make espresso coffee. It's not it. We make machines for the farmer to use, for the exporter, the trader to use. These are machines from the moment you pick the cherry, and we make harvesters, to the moment you export or roast. These machines can cost anywhere from $3,000 to a couple of $1 million.
Wow.
And so it depends on what we want. And we're very proud to say that probably today, 2/3 to 3/4 of the coffee people drink has passed through at least one Pinhalense machine.
It's really interesting because when I was in Colombia visiting some small properties, I could see Pinhalense machinery over there.
That's why I say
I was really proud to say, oh, maybe the coffee is Colombian, but the technology is Brazilian.
Well, the technology is Brazilian everywhere. When people ask, I tend to say we're the Coca-Cola, the Coke of the coffee machinery business, because the name is really everywhere.
Can you list some products that you have in your portfolio?
Well, one interesting one, probably the best-selling product, is the coffee dryer. Because in most people, especially with the climate change today, you have less or fewer sunny days, and so you have to rely more and more on mechanical drying. Also because labor cost is going up. So if you do it by machine, you save a lot on labor. And before you ask, does it change the quality?
Yes.
It's more than proven that the quality is exactly the same. In fact, it can be the other way around, because it's easier for you to control quality with a machine than in a drying ground where people have to revolve coffee every hour or every half hour or every 15 minutes. Do they do it? If they don't, now in the machine, you can control it even digitally today. So quality tends to be better.
So we fantasize about the traditional way.
That's one thing that's against quality in coffee today, because a lot of people in consuming countries think things should be done the same way they were done 100 years ago. In a sense, that was a mistake made by the growers themselves that started to...
It's their marketing.
Quote unquote, to sell this idea that it has to be labor intensive, it has to be manually done. When the reality is, if you look at a corn grower in the United States, probably at the 1900, they could handle themselves 3 or 4 hectares. In 1950, 20 or 30, and today 600 with machines. Why should be coffee different? So we should think of fewer people working and making more money, because that's what sustainability is about. It's not having a lot of people underpaid.
Yes.
That's not the way.
And if Brazil is the first producer in the world, thanks to technology, right?
Absolutely right. Technology with sustainability. It's not technology that affects the environment. It's technology that protects the environment. It's technology that creates social fairness.
But actually, in the past, it wasn't like that, right?
Well, in the past, you have to compare the past with the environment at the time.
Yes,
so
that's right.
The cost of living was much lower. So you could have more and more people picking coffee by hand, because whatever they made was enough for a living. Today, it's not exactly the same. If you have a person picking coffee by hand and comparing it with a handheld harvester, the little hands that shake the coffee bush, This person will pick 5 times more. And of course, he'll make 5 times more, enough for him to buy the machine and to be better off. So in terms of a sustainability, that's much, much better. I know perhaps your question is going to be, what about quality?
Yeah.
I like to say, because people tend to think that God said that people have to pick only the ripe cherries. And that's not what God said. What God said is that good coffee comes from ripe cherries. So it may be economically better to pick a mixture of cherries, ripe and ripe and overripe, sort them by machine, and to make the better coffees only with the ripe cherries. What do I do with the unripe and overripe? They should go to specific markets that are not so quality sensitive.
Yes, because a farm doesn't produce 100% specialty, right?
Absolutely.
It's impossible.
Right. In some areas like Central America, even some areas of Colombia, you can have a farm that produces perhaps 80% specialty or 90% specialty. But that would require selective hand picking, which we know less and less is economically feasible. So the world has to adapt. In a sense, Brazil is showing the path. And today, Colombia is preparing to go mechanical harvesting.
I see.
We have just sold one of the largest and most modern wet mills in Colombia that's already prepared to receive coffee that will eventually be mechanically harvested.
Interesting. Which region over there?
This is in the region of Antioquia, which is one of the most traditional producing regions in Colombia. And this mill will start working in early January.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Great. So some concurrence is coming, right?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Change is the word.
You're Brazilian? Wow, man, I thought you were just a regular white dude.
I am Brazilian and I'm white.
No. You can't be both. You got to choose, bruh.
Hey, Dennis. Can you translate this from English to Spanish for me?
Actually, I speak Portuguese.
Isn't it the same thing?
No, it's not.
Sao Paulo. Hmm? That city's got that huge Jesus statue up on the hill with the big arms out, looking like it's gonna hug everybody.
Yeah, that's actually real, man.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
How did you deal with all that violence? I mean, the child gangs? Slums?
Let me guess, you just watched City of God.
City of God? Yes. Your people go through so much.
So you travel much more than me. You talk to really interesting coffee people, more than me for sure. So you listen some assumptions more often than me. What do you listen on?
Well, several things, like Brazil does not produce washed coffee. Brazilian coffee is low quality, and so on and so forth. Well, first, Brazil has changed substantially the image of not being a coffee a quality producer. You look at Illy Café, for instance, considered high quality coffee. You look at Nespresso. The majority of the coffee in a Nespresso capsule or in an Illy Café cup is Brazilian. And so that shows that Brazilian coffee is associated with quality.
Yes.
But this has not been so all the time. Brazil produces predominantly natural coffee. And in the past, natural coffee used to be associated with poor quality.
Like commodity.
And what you see today is that the world is moving into natural coffees. And natural coffees are very much demanded as something different. In fact, what's the big difference in washed coffee, what Colombia and Central America produce, and naturals that Brazil produce? Washed coffees tend to have a higher acidity and they tend to be more aromatic. Natural coffees, like in Brazil, they're sweeter and have
body.
More body. So they're the ideal ingredient for a high-quality espresso. And the world is moving in the direction of espresso. A nice parallel is that washed coffee can be associated with white wines, and natural coffees can be associated with red wines.
I never thought about it.
It's a very interesting association,
yeah.
Because white wines, they are processed without the peel. Washed coffee is processed without the pulp.
Oh.
Natural coffees are dried with the peel. And red wines are fermented with the peel. That's a very strong parallel, and white wines tend to be more acidic than red wines. And I might then add, the consumption of red wines grows much faster than the consumption of white wines. So that tells you the story about natural.
Nice.
Talking about natural, even though Brazil is by and large a producer of naturals, people think Brazil does not produce washed coffees. I would say that 10% of the Brazilian production is washed coffees. That's about 5 million bags, which makes Brazil one of the top producer of Arabica washed coffees.
Wow.
And we started to do semi-washed, that we call cereja descascado or pulped natural, and that Central America calls honey. This was created by us here in Brazil, by a group of farmers, then supported by Pinhalense, and even the name was created here in Brazil. And it's a concept that has spread around the world. And you might wonder, a country that's not known for washed coffee has created this pulped natural.
A new category,
which I would guess today could easily account for perhaps 10 million bags around the world.
It's a lot of coffee.
Brazil!
Another sort of a preconception, and often you said about when you travel, people say, Brazil is a producer of Robusta, isn't it? Well, biggest mistakes. Why? Because 20 years ago, the production of Robusta in Brazil was negligible. Brazil was 100% Arabica. Brazil started to produce Robusta when we started to create a soluble industry.
I see.
Usually the raw material for soluble is Robusta. And so that's when we started with Conilon. And even today, Arabica accounts for 70% of the Brazilian production, and Conilon Robusta only 30%. And with the recent drought, the Conilon fell down to even 20%. So Brazil is predominantly a producer of Arabica, and growingly a producer of high-quality Arabica. And we're also starting to produce washed Conilons, which are very good quality too.
The point is, we produce a lot of coffee. Doesn't matter if it's Arabica or Robusta. Maybe for this reason we are known about our Robustas too.
It could be. And which leads me to another preconception, and you opened the podcast talking about this, that Brazil is a country of large growers. And you think of coffee barons, of these large farms, plantations in the U.S., in the sense that in the U.S. you understand a plantation, a very large area. And in fact, 86% of the Brazilian growers have less than 20 hectares, fewer than 20 hectares, and they're considered small growers. And their production accounts for 52% of the Brazilian production. So 52% of the Brazilian production comes from small growers. So Brazil is not an exception. It's like all countries around the world. Most of the production comes from small growers, even though the definition of what a small grower is may be different.
Yeah, this I would tell, because in Colombia you can find properties with 5 hectares.
Right. The average for Colombia is about 1.6 hectare average. The average for Brazil is 7.5. The average for...
So the tiny ones are 7 hectares.
The average.
Ah,
If you add them all, the 330,000 coffee growers in Brazil, and you divide it by 2 million hectares, you get 7.5. If you do the same for Colombia, 1.6. For Kenya, 0.5.
I see.
And now, these countries with the very small farms, they're starting to ask themselves, is that sustainable?
I see.
Can they live off that small farm? We're discussing with Ethiopia right now how we can bring farmers together to process coffee together so that they gain economies of scale in processing, in selling, in buying inputs.
And quality standards.
And quality standards too, because it's much easier. That's a very interesting point, Kelly, and I like to be controversial, but I say at the same time that the world is moving into micro lots, the world is moving into world blends. What are these world blends? When I started in this business, in Germany, for instance, what coffee you drank in northeast Germany was different from the coffee you drank in southwest Germany. In southern Italy, totally different from northern Italy. Now, when you have Illy Café with one or two blends around the world, and you have Nespresso with 5, 10, 20 brands, those are world brands.
That's true.
And think of Starbucks. What they call the breakfast blend is basically the same thing around the world. So at the same time you have a demand for micro lots, you have a unique demand for quality coffee in high volumes. How can you get that from a myriad of small growers? So that's a big advantage for Brazil, because Brazil production is integrated, growers are slightly bigger, we have strong cooperatives in a very strong trade sector that can bring together similar qualities to provide, this is what Secafé, our exporters association, calls diversified coffees. It's high quality coffees in high volumes.
It's the beauty of this market, right? You have room for everybody.
It's a very diversified market, and more producers are coming, each in their own different way, into the market.
As soon as the Portuguese set foot on Brazilian lands 500 years ago, they started writing the first chapters of this nation's great history. In 1531, one of these brave navigators, Brás Cubas, arrived in the region and founded the city of Santos. At that time, ships arriving here used to lower their anchors in the Bay of Santos. The idea of moving the quay to the estuary of Santos is credited to Brás Cubas himself, who already in those days was concerned with a safer location for the port in waters better sheltered against frequent pirate attacks. The chosen place was a privileged one, a long berthing channel for the coming vessels.
Another interesting fact, when I travel, I usually go to coffee shops and I ask, do you have Brazilian coffee? So the person says proudly, yes, I do, actually. And where is it from? Which origin? Oh, it's from Santos. Mm-hmm. So this is really boring and sad.
This is a misnomer that started maybe 56, 70 years ago. Most of Brazilian coffee left through the harbor of Santos, as it is still today the case. And so it was associated with the word Santos coffee. And people even thought that was the high-quality Brazilian coffee because the low-quality Brazilian coffee left through Rio. That's why when people have a very specific phenolic chemical taste that's called Rioi, it's because it used to be shipped through the harbor of Rio.
I never knew that Rio exported.
Rio exported all the coffee that came from what we call Matas de Minas. And formerly was called Zona da Mata. So Zona da Mata left Brazil through Rio. And the typical phenolic old taste was the Rioi taste. That's still favored in the Middle East, North Africa, Greece, Turkey. That's what they prefer. When you have Turkish coffee, the ingredient is Rioi coffee. But that's a long time ago.
Just to clarify, this Rio de Janeiro port.
Rio de Janeiro port, very good. And that's why in the year 2000, the Specialty Coffee Association of America invited Brazil to be the theme country, the subject of their conference. And that was the time when Brazil was really first divided in 14 growing regions.
14.
And we had the honor, the privilege, P&A, we created the slogan, One Country, Many Flavors.
I see.
Because people thought Brazil was Santos. And the smarter ones thought it was Santos and Rio.
Oh my
goodness. We then said, Santos and Rio have nothing to do with it. That's when the names, some names were added, Conilon Capixaba, the Robusta, Mountains of Espírito Santo, West of Bahia, Café de São Paulo. These were all created at that time when we had a very democratic process that we called all the representatives of the regions, and we sort of created the definition of the coffee for each region. That was year 2000, at the beginning of the Brazil Specialty Coffee Association.
In that time, you didn't consider the origin denomination.
Origin denominations was not the case yet. This was sort of the seeds for the geographical indications. And then we came with Cerrado, we came with Sao Paulo, the one in Franca, Mogiana, Alta Mogiana, and then we came with South Minas and so on. And Mantiqueira people are working. But this is newer. That was the background work. And now people are using and doing it the way it should be with geographical indications.
Great.
Under the concept of one country, many flavors.
And the results?
Well, the results...
What changed in the world?
That was the sort of a... It's very hard in Brazil to get money for the marketing of coffee because it's a very traditional industry. And for Brazilian decision makers, since we're the largest producer in the world, we don't...
They don't care.
They don't care. But the question is, so in the year 2000, there was a really clear perception by all in the sector that we should create a name for quality in Brazil in the specialty coffee market. And it would trickle down to the rest of the market. And that's the way it has been done ever since. So we invest a lot in the specialty coffee sector on the assumption that you raise the flag of quality for one sector, it will trickle down and benefit all the rest of the business in a sustainable way. And since I'm talking about sustainability, that's one thing that more and more people are learning, that Brazil is the largest source of sustainable coffees in the world.
How come?
Well, because Brazil produces in an environmentally friendly way with social responsibility. And more important, the grower makes money in Brazil. Because if you think of sustainability, and there is a thing in the world today called the Global Coffee Platform. And we, P&A, we run the Brazilian program for the Global Coffee Platform. And we're changing the concept of sustainability with a new paradigm. How did sustainability start? It started because people in consuming countries were worried about the environment. So let's, quote unquote, force the grower to respect the environment. Then they had problems with labor. Do children work? And then they started to think about social responsibility.
But this was Brazil has specific laws related to environment and social too, right?
The
and
most makes, rigorous in the world.
And the cost of production is really high because of that.
That leads me to question. Sustainability, people say, you have to follow and respect the local legislation.
Yes.
Environment and labor. Is it fair that Brazil has a very rigorous legislation and country X has a very lax one? So it costs a lot more to produce sustainable coffee in Brazil than in most other countries. Should we say that Brazilian coffee is more sustainable than the others? That's something for one to think about.
Yes.
But going back to what I was talking about, the changing paradigm. So this sustainability concept came from abroad into the producing countries. And at the beginning, there was a big bait, a big attraction, which was the price premium. But as more and more people started to produce sustainable coffee, the price premium fell, decreased. Yeah. And then why should the grower do it? And what the Global Coffee Platform is doing, especially in Brazil, is to change in the paradigm and showing that if the grower is to be sustainable, he has to make money. Because if he doesn't make money, he will not refrain from cutting trees to cook.
Except.
Or to send the children to school, or have access to medical, to respond to its medical and health needs. So what we're doing here now, we created in Brazil a thing called the Coffee Sustainability Curriculum. And behind the Coffee Sustainability Curriculum is the idea that the first objective of sustainability is for the grower to be more efficient, more productive, because then he or she will make more money, he or she will protect the environment and have a better social standard. So that's changing the paradigm that sustainability is no longer coming from the outside into the producing countries. It should
really
start in the producing countries. And Brazil is a leader in that sense because as we started this point of the conversation, Brazil is today the largest source of sustainable coffee, certified and verified or not. Sustainability is at the basis. But this is not to say that 100% of the Brazilian coffee is sustainable. And the biggest barrier, the biggest challenge now is the very small grower, which is the most difficult to reach. And that's what the Brazil program of the Global Coffee Platform is working on today with the Coffee Sustainability Curriculum. And now it's a message, I think, for your listeners, Kelly. In my view, the word sustainability should have never been created because it's a very abstract concept.
Exactly.
We should say what's sustainability? Is you have to make money when you produce coffee, you have to respect the environment, and you have to have access to social, education, health services. That's something everyone understands.
Yeah, because what I can see in this market is a farmer is just recycling the garbage and they say, I'm sustainable.
By the way, since we're talking about the preconceptions, Brazil is the country in the world that recycles the largest percentage of containers used for agrochemicals, 94%. This is higher than Europe, United States, Canada, Japan. It's the highest in the world. We have the highest recycling rate of containers, packages, cans used for agrochemicals, which surprises most people.
So I've been asked to talk about the trend, challenges in the coffee market, a price, risks, and opportunity. We are living in a moment in the coffee market that we have not seen possibly in the past 10 years. So today's program.
So to wrap it up, all the misconceptions, I would like to overview past and present. Thinking about future tendencies. What are your comments about?
Well, we're talking to a market that's now changing at two ends. You have this third wave coffee requiring micro lots where the consumer knows who the producer is. At the other end of the market, we're talking about world blends. I talked about before. A very interesting trend is that today the consumption of soluble grows faster than the consumption of roast and ground coffee. That's because emerging markets are leading this growth, and emerging markets like India, like China, like Indonesia, which are traditionally consumers of tea. And it's easier for them to move from tea to soluble coffee than to move into roast and ground. And one of the big questions in the future is, well, is this going to be soluble? And the main raw material for soluble is Robusta. So Arabica production is going to taper and come down proportionally, and Robusta is going to grow, and we're going to move into a soluble world. But there are other tendencies. The single doses, the single serve, like capsules and little envelope single serve, are changing the market in the most advanced markets.
Do you believe that the growth of soluble instant coffee comes along with this single serve tendency?
It's two things happening at the same time. Let's look at China. At the same time that China is a big consumer of soluble coffee, perhaps 95%, it's a growth market for the coffee shops. And there will be a point, and we have at our company, we call coffee ladder. And we say that people enter the coffee ladder, non-consumers, with soluble because they're used to tea. But eventually, as the income grows or they are educated in terms of coffee, they're progressively going to change to Arabica. And so we think, my view, this is the trend, the short-term trend, perhaps 5 to 10 years, is that soluble is going to grow faster, but it's going to taper. And then a lot of these consumers, because of coffee shops, because of the single serve, they're going to switch to more Arabica-based blends.
So, yes, this is what people call instant specialty coffee. There is a brand in the US called Sandan Coffee.
Mm-hmm.
They promise, I didn't try yet, but they promise high quality cup of coffee.
Yes, well,
it's like a pull over, but instant.
Yeah, well, that's something one has to evolve. Right now, you have several technologies to produce soluble. The powder soluble, that's called the spray dried, is predominantly Robusta, perhaps 5% of Arabica, if that much. Now, when you move to freeze dried, that's more sophisticated, you get more Arabica because more of the taste of the raw material is transmitted to the cup. So there may be other technologies, and some companies are already experimenting with mixtures of roast and ground and soluble. So the future is a brave new future that we'll have to see, but changes are going to be in the direction of first soluble, and then it's going to move into probably roast and ground, espresso, single serve, and so on and so forth. And we have micro lots, and you have world blends. So
yes,
it's a world we'll have to bring together all these conflicting sources. And there has to be a reinvention of the traditional markets. Traditional markets are West Europe, US, and Japan, because that's the market that grows slower or is lowest in the world. And that reinvention first came through coffee shops. It's now coming through single serve and the third wave. So this market is going to be reinvented by youngsters and so on and so forth. And it's very hard to predict what will be there because there are several trends going on simultaneously.
But this change already started in emerging markets like Indonesia, right?
Well, whatever happens in emerging markets will reflect what the traditional markets do in terms of modernizing. But there is a big difference because the advanced consuming markets, US, Western Europe, and Japan, have income. Whereas the emerging markets, the biggest market to be tapped is low income. So it doesn't, there will be coffee shops, there will be single serve, but will be a small fraction of the market. Whereas the big market, the mass market, will be for lower cost coffee. And right now, this is, for instance, in Indonesia, a little envelope with instant soluble coffee, non-dairy milk, and sugar. That's called the 3-in-1. And it can be flavorized. So this is the fastest growing single serve,
which is
very different from a capsule.
Yes,
but
it's a different public, different prices.
It appeals to the public that there is. In the same way that you can think of the Brazilian market, of a market consuming only specialty coffee, because it's still the largest proportion of the population has to drink a coffee that they can afford.
To finalize our conversation, what would you say to foreigner consumers who are interested about Brazilian coffee?
Well, first of all, there is a paradigm to be broken that Brazilian coffee is not really quality coffee. Most consumers are already drinking a lot of Brazilian coffee, even though they do not know about that. And they should explore really the qualities that Brazil has to offer, both natural, pulped natural, and washed. We have a wide variety. When we say we're 14 producing regions, I don't know if you realize that from the southernmost coffee tree in Brazil to the northernmost coffee tree in Brazil, the distance is equivalent to the distance from Lima, Peru to Guatemala City in Central America.
Yeah.
And in between, there are 8 coffee producing countries. So that's why I would insist, Brazil, one country, many flavors. One cannot think of Brazil as one country. You should think of 14 regions. You should explore 14 regions. If you multiply those 14 regions by 3 processing systems,
yes,
you already get
goodness
to 42. And if you get to Arabic and Robusta, you multiply by 2, that's 84. So it's an endless array of qualities that should really be explored by the consumers.
Coffee, 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 coffee.